man who has spent his life on the front lines of truth and justice, Dr. Howard Fuller. Dr. Fuller, a legendary historian, civil rights advocate, and lifelong educator, will join me to talk about race relations in America and specifically the painful and often overlooked history of racism right here in Milwaukee. This episode is a must-listen for anyone who wants to understand the past and fight for a more just future. Dr. Fuller doesn't hold back, and neither do we. That's the next time on the Earl Ingram Podcast. Don't miss it, airing this week on all streaming platforms. Follow us on civicmedia.us or wherever you follow your podcast. Please like and subscribe as well.
Making myself realize where my foundation was.
Good morning and welcome. This is Earl Ingram, and I have to say I have been honored and privileged in my life to have interviewed many people. I think when I sat down with Dick Gregory for 8 hours, and Dick Gregory said some things to me that I had never forgotten, and just knowing who and what Dick Gregory was and the impact of him and the fact that he would sit down for 8 hours with me, it's one of those things I've never forgotten. Last year, to have been given the honor to interview then President Joe Biden and being the first talk show host in the entire nation to have been given that honor to interview then President Joe Biden after his debate with Donald Trump was, I think, another one of those honors that I'll probably never forget. But I will say those things and all the other people who I've been able to interview, the great Maya Angelou and many others, I've had that privilege and honor. But today, my guest, Dr. Howard Fuller, is up there with probably the one interview that I will cherish the most in my life, because this man, as I was growing up as a young boy in Milwaukee on 4th and Monarchy, in a segregated community in the 1960s, turbulent times, and trying to figure out what was going on and looking around me and not really understanding segregation and integration and all those things as a young boy, but watching those things manifest themselves on television, and they were right before us in my generation, right there. And Dr. Fuller, never will forget living on 4th and Monarchy and watching the tanks rolling down the street, and the guys with their guns drawn, and all of those things. All of those things, Dr. Fuller, are in me. They've helped shape the National Guard. They've kind of shaped who I am. But I remember you as a voice for our community. You were courageous. You were a young man yourself, and yet you were there. And, you know, you and I spoke a little earlier about you never know who you impact when you're talking. You impacted me from the time I was a young boy, and I've never forgotten you. All the other great things that you've accomplished in your life, I said this and I'll repeat it again. Man, I look at you as a brother, and man, it's an honor and a privilege to have the one and only Dr. Howard Fuller with us for a few minutes today. But his story is so long and winding that I'm going to ask him if we can do several of these, because I want people to get to know who Dr. Fuller is. Good morning to you, Dr. Fuller. How you doing, sir?
Hey, man. Good morning, my brother. I don't know what to say after all of that, but I do want to say two or three things. First of all, it's humbling to even have you or anyone put my name in a category with people like Dick Gregory and Maya Angelou and you know, Joe Biden for a different reason. Right. But, you know, I mean, he's someone I respect too, but it's a different type of respect, you know, and, you know, which we could obviously talk about. But I'm deeply grateful that you would, you know, see me that in that, you know, in that way. But I don't see myself.
I know.
You know, like at that level.
Well, you've never been that, but go ahead.
Yeah. The second thing I want to say is I want to thank you for having me on the program this morning. And I hope the conversation that we have will be useful, you know, to the audience or to whomever, you know, obviously is listening. But then the third thing I want to say is I wanted to thank you personally for the facilitating the We Are the Drum Award. I got my We Are the Drum hoodie on.
Yeah, you do, man. Thank you.
Yeah, I do. and you know, Capital Productions Incorporated, the scholarship fund, and all of the people who are associated with that great organization and that great work. So this gives me an opportunity to publicly thank you for that. And I appreciate it.
So who is Dr. Howard Fuller?
I guess it depends on what day you ask.
I know. You know, let's begin at you know, the early stages of your life, because who you are is all of those different experiences.
Yeah, so I appreciate that question. And as you and I were talking earlier, you know, I actually did finally do a book, Earl, and it's called No Struggle, No Progress. And I did the book for several different reasons. And I hope that explaining this will help me answer your question. So one of the reasons I did the book is because there are now about 70 books out there that mention me in one way or another. Some of them, you know, in more detail, some of them just a quote and this and that. And I know that because there's a young brother who is working on a book about me now. And we were doing research on, you know, the books out there. And so one of the reasons I decided to write my book was I realized that if I didn't hurry up and tell my own story, that whatever else other people had to say about me would be the only story that was out there.
Right.
So in 2014, working with a woman named Lisa Frazier Page, who worked with the three doctors when they were in high school in Newark to write a book called The Pact. And that was about three young men in Newark who had a pact to become doctors. Two of them became doctors and one of them became a dentist. And she collaborated with them to write their book. And she also collaborated with one of the Little Rock Nine, I think it was Carlotta. So I was very fortunate to get her to collaborate with me to write my book. So in talking about, you know, like, you know, who I am, I, where did I come from and so forth. I wrote the book because I wanted to also honor my mother and my grandmother, because they're the two most important people in my life. I would not be where I am today, wherever that is, without their support and guidance and all of the things that they did for in my life. So I actually came to Milwaukee in the early 1940s. My mother had moved up here to take care of a cousin of ours who was sick. Because back in the day, you know, people did that, where if there was a family member that was sick, some family member would go to, you know, to take care of them. That was just the way it was, right? And so my grandmother sent my mother up here to help deal with my cousin. And her and my stepfather ended up moving here. So in about a year and a half or something like that, she came to get me. So I spent the first year and a half of my life with my grandmother. And then I moved up here. It was in 1946, believe it or not. And so, you know, we lived over on 11th Street between Reservoir and Vine. And so I went to St. Boniface the first 7 years of, you know, my schooling. And then we moved over to Hillside, you know, over into the projects. And I got kicked out of St. Boniface because of behavior problems. And so I ended up going to Lincoln in the eighth grade, because if you lived in the projects during then, you went to Lincoln. And ironically, Earl, one of my classmates in eighth grade was Al Jarreau. Wow. And in fact, when Al passed, I posted on my Twitter account. I don't have a Twitter account no more because of Elon Musk.
Right.
I posted on my Twitter account the page and the quill, which was the yearbook, because Al and I were on the same page in the eighth grade. And so I carried that around with me on my phone. Then we moved from the projects back over to 11th Street. In fact, in the same block where we were at first. And because I lived on the west side of 11th Street, the best thing in the world happened to me. I had to go to North Division. And so I ended up going to North. And back then, North was, when I went there as a ninth grader, it was about 75% white. And so I was in the period when it changed over to, by the time I graduated, it was about 75% black. And, you know, I played on the first team from Milwaukee basketball team to ever go to the state tournament. We went my junior year and we won the consolation championship. My senior year, we lost to Madison East in the final 62-59. Not that I remember. And we got cheated. But anyway, no, we didn't get cheated. But because of my ability to play basketball, I was recruited by New Mexico and also near the end by Marquette. But I ended up going to Carroll. It was Carroll College at that time because Mr. Wesley Scott was the head of the Urban League. And I was involved in the Urban League. And they were trying to, at that period of history, try to get some black students to go to state colleges in Wisconsin. And so I went to Carroll. And I am the first black male to graduate from what is now Carroll University.
So before we get so far down the road, I have to go back to you leaving Lincoln to go to North. Back in those days, that was a monumental move because Lincoln and North were kind of like, you know, the yin and the yang. And both very talented athletes, very smart people, leaders in the city in black Milwaukee, attended both Lincoln and North Division. And I remember you, as I was a young boy, being that great basketball player. And the coach, what was the coach's name?
Vic Anderson.
Yes, Vic Anderson. And so all of those things, I just didn't want to get so far down the road. That had to be eye-opening to leave Lincoln and go to North.
Yeah, but, you know, we all grew up together. All lived in the same neighborhood. And so the Lincoln-North game, as you know, was the game back then. You know, to the extent that we used to have an alumni game that lasted at least
40 years.
About, you know, 15 years or more. You know, because it was that type of rivalry and that type of relationship. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, like, wasn't,
you know, with Larry Reed and Butch Carter and all that.
Oh, yeah.
And the one thing that I can say is that Lincoln never beat us during the time when I was there.
You're still carrying that. You're still carrying.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But Earl, you know, like a real interesting story, a real quick story that your listeners might find interesting. Was in 1958 is when I graduated from high school, and you know, we went to the state tournament. Well, in 1959, the year after I graduated, the powers to be in Wisconsin basketball made the mistake of putting Lincoln and North in different brackets to get to the state tournament. So in 1959, North ended up playing Lincoln for the state championship. You know, and this was, and so the year after I graduated, but it was, you know, Dr. Harry Oden, you know, Marvin Fuller.
Absolutely.
Lincoln had Andy Chesser, Fats Lamar, Charlie Houston. They played each other, Earl, for the state championship of the state of Wisconsin. Hey,
Dr. Fuller, the significance of that is back then, the black percentage in Wisconsin must have been 2%.
Or less. I used to tell people all the time, Earl, that if you were fishing up north and you got lost and you saw some black person, you shouldn't ask them for directions because they was probably lost.
Yep.
No, but
the fact that they had these two black teams from Milwaukee at the state was just something that was incomprehensible.
It was. And the next year, they made sure that that wasn't going to happen because we played each other in the first game of the sub-region.
These stories and these things, I think, just kind of point out, because the rest of your journey is so historical, Dr. Fuller, that I think it's important people see you solely as Dr. Fuller, the educator, and all of those other things. But there's always been this other side of you, humorous side, for people who know you. And so I wanted to make sure that that side of who Dr. Fuller is kind of gets out.
No, I really appreciate that. And the reason why that's important is when I talk to the kids at our school today, you know, one of the things I say to them sometimes is, you know, like I ran these same streets that y'all running, right?
Right.
And so one of the most important things for me was the support that I got when I was growing up in the city of Milwaukee. And you refer to it, you know, as being segregated, you know, which it was and to some extent probably still is, but we never viewed it that way.
That's right.
Because it was the community that we grew up in, right? And literally because of the types of policies that existed back then, housing policies and all of that, you had a much different black community, obviously, than you have today.
No question.
Because all of the different classes of black people were literally forced to live together. And so you were, you know, interacting with those in our community who had the least and those in our community who had the most. And so it was a totally different situation than what our young people are experiencing today. And I do believe with all of my heart that what young people are trying to negotiate today is much, much, much more complex and difficult than the community that I lived in back, you know, back, quote, in the day. And obviously there were and continue to be negative things about that community, but there were many, many assets that existed in that community that unfortunately I don't see, you know, today, at least at the same level. There's always assets in a community, no matter how people look at it, but it's a little bit different than it was when I was growing up.
You know, Dr. Fuller, you're a little bit older than I am, but I grew up in that same community. And I long for that community. And I talk to young people about that because there's a difference between a community and a neighborhood. And we had that, okay? And so young people today, I always tell them of that. And one of the reasons that I am so passionate about fighting and struggling and continuing to fight for young people is because they deserve the same shot that you and I had. Now, you wound up going to a parochial school. What relationship, because you're an educator and education is at the apex of everything that Dr. Fuller basically is doing and has been for a long time. What correlation between the parochial school education you got as a young man and the public school education you got?
Right. Yeah, let me respond to that, Earl. But let me start by reminding people that Gladys Knight has a song. It's called The Way That We Were.
Yes, sir.
And one of the things she says in that song is, come to think about it, today will be the good old days for our children.
That's correct.
So no matter what it is, you know, old people like myself are thinking, for young people today, these are, quote, the good old days in their lives, right?
Yes.
And when they get as old as you are, and hopefully get as old as I am, you know, whatever it is, these will be the defining memories, you know, for their time. You know what I mean? And we just have to to try to understand that. But to get directly to your question, so going to St. Boniface, the nuns made sure that I knew how to read. I mean, and so when I went to Lincoln, we also had great teachers. And when I went to North, we had great teachers. Ironically, I only had one Black teacher the whole time I was at North Division. Mr. Withers was the Phi Ed teacher. There were no Black teachers at North Division when I went there. And that's an important point we can come back to later. But what I will say is the education that I received in the Milwaukee Public Schools prepared me to go to Carroll, prepared me to do the things that I've been able to do throughout, you know, my lifetime. But what was interesting was I was able to experience both private schools and public schools. And it's one of the reasons that I'm so vehement about trying to give people the option to try to find the best place for their children. And that we should not be hung up on what type of school it is. We should be hung up on what is the education that kids are receiving. How do we make sure that we provide the best options for our children? And I know that there are people out there who vehemently disagree with me on that, particularly when it comes to charter schools and vouchers and so forth. And I'm not hung up on. I mean, people are just going to disagree. But at the end of the day, Earl, at the end of the day, man, if we don't figure out ways to give our children the best education possible, it's not possible to have a community that we all want to live in. It's just not possible.
You know, Dr. Fuller, we're going to get into all those things, but I have to. Being the only Black in that parochial school, how... You know, I'm a guy who went, Dr. Fuller, from Garfield Avenue School, which was all Black, from kindergarten all the way through sixth grade, and then by 1968 or whenever the open housing, I wound up going to a 99% white school. It was life changing for me, and so it kind of shaped who I am today. What role did that play in your life going to an all white school as a young man and then winding up eventually going to schools that were where you got to see other Blacks? Did it have
any? You know, what's interesting about that question, Earl, is I don't remember a lot of about the St. Boniface experience in that regard.
Right.
But I can speak to it a lot more in being the only Black student at Carroll, and being out there by myself for the first couple of years, and then, you know, Bradley Carr came out there, and then ultimately Irie, yes, and all of that, right? And what I tell people all the time is that was a bittersweet experience for me. And what I mean by that is, at Carroll, I made lifelong friends, people like Bill and Carla Mullen, my roommate who just passed a couple of years ago, and his wife, Judy, you know, the Hickeys, there are friendships that I made at Carroll where those of us who are still alive, we are still friends today, right? But being in that situation where you're the only Black person, it was a trying experience. And the way I try to describe it is being in two worlds and not being in either one. So you're out there trying to figure out, you know, how do I negotiate this? Because imagine this, Earl. You leave North Division, that by the time I was a senior, it was almost all Black.
Right.
My mother dropped me off in Waukesha. I was 17 years old. There wasn't a single Black person nowhere. The Waukesha that it is, that it is today. There weren't even no Black people working at Carroll, man. And my mother dropped me off, and I was like, okay, I got to figure out how to negotiate this, right?
Militancy wasn't the order of the day.
Yeah, right. And so I'm trying to figure out, well, you know, why you talk this way? Why you got a mustache? All kinds of stuff like that. And then when I would come home, you know, my friends, hey man, you talk funny. So what happens is you're trying to negotiate, you know, these two worlds, right? But it's an experience that I wouldn't want anybody else to go through, honestly. But it was an experience that prepared me, you know, to deal with the world that I ended up having to deal with in my lifetime.
You know, Dr. Fuller, it's such a relevant statement. You know, I kind of feel the same way when I went from an all black reality to an all white one. It shaped who I am today. I wouldn't want to have done it any other way, because it prepared me to be able to deal with the world as the world is. And, yep. You know, that those are the kinds of lessons, I guess, that we can say have been so very important in our lives. And for, on the flip side of that, for people who have never had the opportunity to be with people other than who they are, really hurts the people who have never had a chance. Not that they're not good or bad, but if you've never had to experience somebody else other than your own nationality and your own, you really kind of miss something, right?
Yeah, plus, honestly, Earl, it helps me see the world in a certain kind of way. Both my experience there, but, you know, the experiences that I've had after that. And so, for example, for me, I do see a very clear difference between what I would call institutional racism versus individual racism. Right. I really do. And I don't see all white people as, by definition, racist. That's just not...
It's inconceivable. It's ridiculous, right?
Yeah. I mean, at least in the way I see the world, well, right? I mean, yeah. There's no way I could feel that way and have the friends that I have and know what phenomenal people these people are.
Right.
But that doesn't stop me from seeing how institutional racism works. It doesn't stop me from seeing individuals who are racist, right? And being able to understand that. But also being able to understand the role that class plays in the conditions that we find ourselves in, and particularly those amongst us who don't have the resources to live the type of life that I wish that everyone could live. So that when I'm looking at the world, I'm looking at a world where race plays a critical role in what happens, where class plays a critical role in what's happening, and just the inertia of institutions and processes and all that, how all of that comes together to hold a people down. But yet you and I both know that in spite of all of that, if young people get an education, at least at an individual level, they'll have a chance to break through. You know, like I tell young people all the time that if you're poor and you're black in America, and education guarantees you nothing, but I can guarantee you will have nothing without an education. You know, it's you know, that's the reality of it. And at the end of my book, one of the things that I concluded is after 50 years of working on certain things, I view education, for example, as a rescue mission. I don't view it as a systemic change instrument as some people do. I view that all of the work that I have done and continue to try to do is to rescue as many people as I possibly can to try to put them on a path where they can have the best life possible.
You know, Dr. Fuller, that is so thoughtful and well thought out and well said, because you just look at a time and a place, and if ever education has always been important, and you've reached the pinnacle of education. But Dr. Fuller, you know, back in the 60s, you could walk into industry, A. O. Smith, Allen Bradley, Alex Chalmers, American Motors, Slitz, Miller, Pabst, and you could not even have a high school diploma, and you could realize the American dream. We saw it in the neighborhoods and in the communities that we lived in, because the majority of our people weren't, at that time, did not have even college degrees. At the most, those had, you know, high school diplomas, but these the automotive industry, the Industrial Revolution, all those things in Milwaukee, it was the machine shop of the world, and we saw that middle class lifestyle that our parents and grandparents were able to live. And so,
yeah, Earl, you know, what I would say to that is I think that's an important point you're making, because what I would say is that if you look at Milwaukee, I don't think, and maybe people disagree, but I don't think that Milwaukee has ever had a dominant or large Black business class.
That's correct.
And what I would say is that people like my mother and my stepfather and you know, their contemporaries and all that, to a certain extent, were able to live what might be characterized as a middle class existence, because both of them had two working class jobs. And when A.O. Smith closed, for example, you know that that was devastating to the Black community, particularly to Black men. So when A.O. Smith and Armour's and Laddish and all of those places where Black men in particular were able to find jobs. And I'm not trying to downplay the role that Black women have played in our development or anything like that. What I'm trying to get people to see is at one point in time, there were places that hired predominantly Black men.
That's correct.
You know, who could bring in income. And so like my mother, for example, you know, her and Miss Dolores and all of them worked at a place up on 6th and Wisconsin Avenue, or not Wisconsin, Walnut. I'm sorry, 6th and Walnut. And what it was back in the day, service stations used to have cloth towels.
Yes, I
remember
those.
To wipe off the windshields and so forth, right? And so my mother and a number of Black women worked 8 hours a day in this place where they made the towels, and then they would pick them up at the service stations and they would bring them back. And my mother, Mr. Lawrence and them, they stood there 8 hours a day, Earl, because these cloth towels would come back. They would put them in a great big a washing machine,
right,
and then a dryer. And what my mother and these other women did was to fold those towels,
wow,
for 8 hours a day.
Wow.
And my mother died of a breathing disorder. And to this day, I believe the reason why she got that was because they were breathing in all of that lint.
Right.
From, because there were no safety measures.
There was no OSHA. There was no OSHA.
Yeah, there wasn't none of that, right?
Right.
And then she worked for 20 or 25 years as a clerk, a ward clerk, at what was Milwaukee County Hospital, right?
Right.
And the irony of that, Earl, is her son, me, was the head of the Department of Health and Human Services that I changed to Department of Human Services.
Right.
When Frater acquired Milwaukee County Hospital. I was the head of the department when the negotiations took place for the Milwaukee County Hospital to go out of existence and become a part of Frater. So you see that dichotomy between, here's my mother, who is a ward clerk, and her son gets to be, quote, the head of the agency.
So you know, Dr. Fuller, the reason that I just, there's so much about your story, and we could have come on and talked about what you're doing with the schools, and we will, but your story and the different hats that you've had on, and not only in this city but across the state, and the different bridges that you've crossed, I think people need to know that when they hear Dr. Fuller, they don't hear, oh yeah, that's the guy who was part of creating the voucher system. There's so much more to you, and I wanted to make sure that we kind of captured that. You know, you talked about A.O. Smith. My father raised 13 of us. And he worked at A.O. Smith, and my mother stayed home. That's the reality of what an American Motors, that's what it was. He came from Arkansas and many others, and those jobs were there. I retired from A.O. Smith after 34 years. I know those stories. I know the history of what our communities were like. Dr. Fuller, those were times when the dollars circulated in our community because the men who worked in those factories were able to own their own little businesses. And so we had that intact community, which has long since been gone. And yes, I long for that, but you know.
Yeah, you know, Earl, like when people talk about segregation, I mean, one of the things that I have always tried to do is to make a clear distinction between segregation, which were the laws, the legal statutes and rules and regulations that discriminated based on race. And people can talk all they want, but there's a clear history of that, right? There were housing covenants in the city of Milwaukee where they were explicit about not being able to rent or have Black people purchase homes. If you read Trotter's book, The Making of a Black Proletariat, where he talks about when Black people came to Milwaukee and resided in what is now the Third Ward, he talked about the Negro jobs that existed, you know, back in the day. Back in 1960, Mayor Zeidler put together a commission and they issued a report on the problems of the inner core, which was a euphemism for the Black community. And I've read that report. And you could take that report, honestly, Earl, and modernize the language and put a different title on it, and you would have what we're experiencing today, albeit with a much deeper level of economic, I'm going to say depression, you know, more broadly.
Right.
You know, in the community. But the point I'm trying to make here is that the segregated community that you're talking about, one of the things that it did was it forced the Black community to be together more as a whole. And so Black people, if you wanted to go to a restaurant, so there was Speed Queen. You know what I mean? You can go back and look at when the Cogs owned the tavern on the corner right. of and Walnut. You know, when Walnut was the business street for Black people.
Yeah.
And so because of the segregated nature of the economy, there was just a different set of relationships both within the Black community. And then the, quote, leaders of the Black community who negotiated for us with the white community. It was just a very different
world. So, Dr. Fuller, is it safe to say that Milwaukee was not alone in that, that was the rule across the nation where we were, you know, located?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's you like the time that I spent in Durham, for example, because Durham at one point in time was what Atlanta is today. It was the pinnacle of, quote, Black economic development, because you had Mutual Savings and Loan, North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company, Mechanics, Farmers and Bank. And there have been books written about Durham as this place where there was a level of Black economic development. But the reason why a lot of that stuff worked like that, Earl, was because Black people, for example, couldn't purchase insurance policies from white insurance companies. So they purchased their insurance from the insurance company that was created by Black people. So what I'm trying to say to people, there was a point in time where because of the segregated nature of the economy, you had more black businesses, you had more black control over certain types of institutional arrangements. And the irony of the civil rights movement, which I'm glad happened, is that, for example, at one point in time, if you wanted to be a black professional, you had two options, teaching and preaching. Right. And then later on, the post office opened up. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. and so at one point in time, for example, you black women who wanted to be professionals, teaching was their option. And so you had the greatest black minds in these all black schools, you know, teaching children. And there was a much more collective, collective value construct that talked about, we're going to make sure that you're going to be better off than we are. You had these teachers who were in there like, you're going to learn. You know what I mean? And so we shouldn't romanticize that period either, right? Because that was a period of subjugation and black people were making do. But that was not the type of open society that we wanted, right? But the last point I'll make on this is, anytime you look at any period of history, the mistake is to see all of it as negative or all of it as positive. That if you do any type of intellectually honest assessment of any historical period of time, you have to look at both the positives and the negatives. And you have to try to understand what the forces were that were operating at that moment in history, and how did we take advantage of it, but how did it also oppress us? It's a difficult way to look at the world.
You know, Dr. Fuller, you were able to spend time in the South as well as the North. You talked about Atlanta and you know, places like North Carolina and those places, black universities were in the South. Yes. And so they certainly, in some instances, you would have to say that, I would ask the question, because I haven't ever lived in the South, that they benefited from having those black universities in the South. We didn't have them in the North. Did that play some role in the advancement of many of those cities and towns, Charlotte and all those other places?
I think without a doubt, man. I mean, the role of HBCUs, both in terms of what you just said, the impact on those individual cities, but also the impact on the United States and the world. Because if you go back and look at the W.E.B. Du Boises of the world, people can like Booker T or don't like Booker T, but there's Tuskegee Institute. And so at one point in time, those black universities were the development grounds for the black leadership class, you know, going back to Du Bois, Allen, 10th, and so forth, right? And so anybody with a brain would have to understand the significant role that HBCUs played and continue to play, although they're in a very difficult place at this moment in history. And one of the ironies that I've always thought about is how you have people who benefited because of the existence of black universities and colleges who oppose black schools at the elementary and high school level. I've never understood that thought process. Because even, Earl, if you go back and read the Brown decision, as I have over and over again, I've done research, I've made presentations on the Brown decision. If you go back and look at footnote 11, which is the social science literature that was the basis for Warren's statement about anything that is all black is inherently unequal.
Right.
That when you go back and look at that literature, like, for example, Gurney Myrdal's book, An American Dilemma, is quoted in footnote 11. And in his book, when he talked about the black community, he talked about the black community as being pathological. There's an article by a dude named Usabel, A-U-S-B-E-L, that talked about blackness being something that was seared on the consciousness of people, and that that in and of itself was detrimental to black people. So there was a part of the Brown decision which was revolutionary in a sense, because it was a blow against legal apartheid.
Yes, sir.
But there was another part of the Brown decision that made the statement that because something is all black, it is by definition inherently unequal, that I've always taken issue with, right? And so what you and I are talking about, when you talk about the segregated Milwaukee or Durham, you have to look at what were the elements of that segregated community, quote, segregated community, that was positive. And then what were the elements that were negative? What did we gain in the civil rights movement, and what did we lose? And then you take all of that and you look at the world that we are currently trying to negotiate, when there is an outright attack on many of the gains that were made during that whole civil rights period.
You know, Dr. Fuller, that this is as good a time as any. I was going to ask you about where we are today, when you look and see that almost all those gains of the civil rights years have been removed. And, you know, affirmative action, which opened some doors, and many would argue, those in the know would argue, that affirmative action benefited white women more than it did anybody. And it was at least an opportunity to open some doors for blacks, and to try to right some of the wrongs, never to the degree that it would change the trajectory of you know, where blacks were headed. You look at what's taking place with the you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion right now, all the different components that were set in place to address racism, bigotry, segregation, all those kind of things have been wiped away, Dr. Fuller, without, you know, not much being said. Your thoughts, you dedicated a segment of your life to fighting that. What are your thoughts today?
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of different thoughts. One of them, right, it's strange, as this right here is Thurgood Marshall's dissent on the Bakke case. And the reason why I'm rereading his dissent is because I'm also reading a book right now called The End of Race Politics. And it talks about we should all be talking about a colorblind society,
right,
which I actually agree with, except it's not real.
Yeah.
in the world in which we, you know, in which we live. And I want to make sure I clearly understand again what Thurgood Marshall said when he wrote his dissent on the Bakke case. And so the way I look at the world today, anyone who doesn't see that Trump is a white supremacist with a clear racist agenda is, I don't know what to say. But that's not to say that the issue is just Trump himself. It's
right.
Trump, to me, is a manifestation of something more, and he happens to be the president of the United States, which is a big, it happens, he happens to be.
Right.
And he's in a position to do certain things, right? But when you battle against something like what we have today, it's a difficult battle to fight, because not all of the policies that have come out of DEI and all of that are positive. You can go back, for example, and look at certain things that happened with the Rescue Act, let's say, which took place during COVID. And you can look at how certain policies were implemented. And the way that some of these policies were implemented did in fact create a level of racial animosity that didn't have to be created. Right. So one of the things that you always worry about is every public policy has an upside and a downside. And one of the things that Thurgood Marshall talked about is it's not possible to address racial wrongs that have happened historically without using race as a way to address some of those wrongs, right? So when you begin to talk about creating policies that say Black people or brown people or women or people with disabilities, you can't act like these people have never been discriminated against, right?
Right.
And so you can't act like you can start a race and somebody's got a 100-pound weight on their leg and the race is 100 yards. You run 50 yards and you stop. And then you say, okay, I'm going to take the weight off your leg, but I'm not going to do anything to try to address the head start that the person got who didn't have the weight on their leg. That's not a reasonable way to look at things. But by the same token, if you go too far in trying to create an equitable situation, you then will create something that turns into something that you literally didn't want to have happen. And so I know that may sound kind of, I hope it's not gibberish or anything, but what I'm trying to say to people is, we have to fight to make sure that all people are treated equally in this society. The problem is, because we've never really had, from the birth of this country, a country that in fact operated on that basis, as you try to address these historical and contemporary issues, you end up necessarily having to take, I'm gonna use the word affirmative action to try to address those ills. And when you do that, you can go too far and create a situation that allows a person like Donald Trump to come in and use those issues in a way that goes way beyond what happened. And so, for example, if you say, we're going to have an immigration policy and we're going to get rid of X numbers of people, but we're going to go and get white South Africans and we're going to say it's okay. How do you do that and then say we're not using race?
You know what I mean? Dr. Fuller, it nauseates me to know that going back to Thurgood Marshall and the people at that time and the impact that his discussions on the Supreme Court had to get a society at that point in time, a racist society, to say, okay, yes, we have to do something to address these issues. If you could go back to that time and realize the conversations that were being had and that man, Thurgood Marshall, was able to put on the plate, and then the movements going on to get the people of that time to say, okay, yes, we see that we've done some things unjustly and we need to make these adjustments. The difference between the thoughts during those times, Dr. Fuller, and those people and people of today who don't see it through that prism, what do you attribute that to?
Well, you have to attribute it to, in my view, the pendulum swings
too far
in the way that America operates. So, for example, when people say, well, we never had a time like this. Well, you need to go back and read what happened right after Lincoln was assassinated and Andrew Johnson took over as the president of the United States. I mean, there can be no period exactly like this because we've never been in this historical moment. You know what I'm saying? In other words, I can go back and show you policies and stuff that were established during Johnson's time that are similar to some of the things that are being done today. The difference is that history doesn't repeat itself in a circle like that. It repeats itself in a kind of a this way. And so what you may see that is happening now is similar to what happened previously, but it happened at a different historical moment. And so the moment that we're in is not the same as the moment we were in under Andrew Johnson, even though some of the things that you see that are being done are similar, But they can't be the same because it's all operating under a totally different set of historical conditions. And so the way I look at it, Earl, is, and I take this from Frantz Fanon's book, Wretched of the Earth. And he said that every generation out of relative obscurity must discover its mission and either fulfill it or betray it. And what I've always believed is every one of us who are living at a particular moment in history, we have to try to understand what is happening at this moment in history. And we have to try to figure out, given our particular view of the world, how do we wage struggle to make life better for everyone? And I believe that you, me, young people today, whoever is alive that still believes that, you know, that this still is a work in progress. And by this, I mean the United States of America. Because if you go back to
still
the preamble.
Still a young nation.
Yeah, you go back to the preamble, we are a people and we're working for a more perfect union, right?
Yes.
That work goes on, right? That work has never stopped. And at different moments in history, you face different obstacles to, in fact, making this the place that at least those beautiful words seem to imply.
You know, Dr. Fuller, as we are coming close to ending this first, which I hope is going to be many opportunities to have this dialogue with you. I think in many instances, in my case, a reawakening of my soul and my spirit, because like you, I believe that we have a responsibility, those of us who are still here, we owe something to the generation that's presently here, and it's worth us waking up every day. You clearly have dedicated the remainder of your life to doing that, and I just wish we had more time today, but I know we don't. But Dr. Fuller, it's the beginning of what I hope will be several opportunities to really get people to get to see and know who Dr. Howard Fuller is. And I'll say this, at the end of, you know, this story that we are telling, this life of a committed man, a servant, Dr. Fuller, if we don't get a chance to come and take a tour of a visual tour of your school, I want at the end of this, I want to make sure that we come there with our cameras and you give us an opportunity to take a look at that spectacular facility that has your name on both of them. We would certainly have wasted our time.
Well, Earl, thank you. And now there's three of them because we just acquired an elementary school. So it's now going to be a K through 12.
Oh, where is that going to be?
So the school that I helped start 25 years ago, Central City Cyber School.
I know exactly where that is.
That's in Parkland. And so it now will become a part of HFCA.
All right.
Yeah, but I did want to, you know, sign off with this based on sort of how you we're bringing this to a conclusion. And so there's a tagline in my email that says, and this, I said it when you all gave me that award, but it says that the drums of Africa still beat in my heart. They will not let me rest while there is a single Negro boy or girl without a chance to prove his, and I added, or her worth. And that was a statement by Mary Cloud Bethune. And so I live my life that way, right? I'm 84, I'm fortunate, whatever. And I believe as long as I got a breath and any mental ability, people might say you lost that years ago, but any mental ability, I have a responsibility to fight for our people. Because I think you and I live by the same notion that to those of us who much is given, much is required. And I feel like much has been given to me and much is required of me to fight for those of us who have the least in our community and in our society.
So Dr. Fuller, we'll stick a pin in it for now. And I can't wait until we have the second go round. I promise you I won't drag it out as long as I did the beginning, but your story is just a story that I don't want to miss much of it, because there's so much more ahead. Thank you very much for taking the time out. Until we get a chance to reconvene, I love you, and man, we're going to make sure that this gets across this entire state and hopefully across the entire nation.
Thank you, my brother, and thanks to Cardi too, man.
All right.
It's good meeting you.
We'll talk soon. That's the one and only Dr. Howard Fuller.